I could have totally been murdered and never seen or heard from again. Then we'd play Wheel of Musical Impressions. Oh, what a hoot it would be. By spring 2012, I'd at last saved enough cash to look for my own place. Manhattan was out of the question. Rents were too high. Why don't you move to Hoboken? My friend Katie suggested. She was already living there with her boyfriend and now husband, Henry, and loved it. It's an easy commute to the city, it's a cute area, and you can find a cheap place close to me. A month of pavement pounding later, I signed a lease on a studio for $750 a month. It was so small that I hit my butt on the radiator whenever I got out of bed. But hey, it was all mine, and it was affordable. 7 whole years. That's how long it had been since I'd seen my family. Almost weekly, Mommy rang me from Madrid. Honey, I miss you, she'd say on the voicemail. Please come visit. It's not the same here. It's nothing like Colombia. It'll just be the two of us, no distractions. Ring me back. I rarely did. But that didn't stop my mother from calling again. And again. And again. Someone should give her the award for most persistent parent because I don't know any mom who has reached out to her child more frequently than my mom. Even after she'd been terribly shunned. In Hoboken, I felt like a real grown-up for the first time. I could come and go as I pleased. I could hang out as late as I wanted without a boyfriend blowing up my phone with text. I could sit in peace and think, and the sort of work I did in class had me thinking a whole lot. What is blocking you? Marishka would ask, prodding us during our exercises. What walls do you still have up? Every wall that I'd erected had something to do with the subject I'd chronically avoided, my family's breakup. And yet, week after week, class after class, it became increasingly clear to me that I was blocked. Majorly. When I'd try a scene, I'd have a hard time being open to certain feelings. I had trouble with intimacy. The closer I came to any emotion that made me feel powerless, the more I shut down. In late 2012, I found myself at a crossroads. I knew that in order to get on with this next chapter in my life, to continue growing as an actor and as a woman, I needed to connect with the woman who gave me life. I had this huge aspiration to be a successful actor, and many times I'd find myself wishing I had my mother there with me, just to share things with her. I miss Papi too, of course, but I've always had more of a complicated relationship with my mother. In my mind, Papi had been the one who'd sacrificed so much to keep my life as steady as possible. He'd been the savior, the nurturer, the anchor. They'd both been snatched from my life, but Mommy was the one I resented. The one who'd been in and out of my world during that critical passage when my body was changing more quickly than the circumstances in our home. I needed her, and she wasn't there for me. Through her choices, she'd made herself a big target for deportation, and in so doing, she'd missed out on some of the most important experiences of my childhood. Buying my first bra, dealing with my period, boys, growing from a girl into a young woman. Yes, I pretended at the time that her absence didn't matter to me, that I was perfectly fine, that Papi's presence was enough. I shrugged it all off as no big deal and refused to talk to anyone about it. But deep down, I judged her and held her most responsible for the mess our lives had turned out to be. In my mind, my father was the hero of our family storyline, and I'd cast Mommy as the villain. Mommy had relocated to Spain 6 years earlier out of desperation. In Colombia, she and my dad weren't talking. I'd gradually slipped away from her, and she was struggling financially. So what was the point in staying? None. Her brother, who'd become a Spanish citizen and who'd since retired from his work as a bullfighter, had taken her in until she could afford a place of her own. She'd eventually gotten a job as a house cleaner, saved up money, and moved into her own small place. In some ways, she and I were on parallel paths. We were both reinventing ourselves, starting over, rewriting our narratives. Mommy, I'm coming to see you. I called to tell her early one Friday morning. The line went silent, probably because she was twice stunned. First, that I was calling, and the second, that I was planning a 2-week trip to visit her. That's wonderful, Diane, she said, her voice shaking around the edges, It'll be so great to see you again. In October 2012, I boarded a flight from JFK to Madrid. Most of the way there, I stared dreamily from the window, wondering how my mom would be different, how her life had shifted since that Christmas I'd traveled to Colombia, how she was faring in a new country. So many years had passed since our last meeting that I felt I was going to see a stranger. Mommy had agreed to meet me in baggage claim. The woman who showed up there that evening was not the mom I remembered. I wheeled my suitcase through the sliding doors leading to the waiting area.
Diane! I heard. Over here!
Mommy and her girlfriend, another Colombian woman, were both waving and rushing towards me. Is that her? I thought. Before I could get a great look, she darted forward and threw her arms around me.
Oh, princess, she said, squeezing me long and hard. It's been so long.
I backed up, blinked back tears, and gazed at her. Oh, my Lord. My mother's nose was different. Completely. Back when our family was still together, Mommy had often mentioned wanting a nose job.
You don't need one, I told her. I like your nose the way it is.
I'd always thought it was pretty distinguished, large, and with an arched bridge. As a small child, I remember reaching up to touch it, and I thought it had a certain elegance to it. For as long as I can remember, she called it her witch nose. At some point during all those years while I was busy ignoring her calls, she'd gotten the surgery. I stood there and gawked at her. Her nose wasn't like Michael Jackson style different. It had just lost its big arch. She was also fit, tanned, and toned, like she'd been hitting the gym daily. She was wearing a pair of dark wash Levi's and a cute blouse. Her hair was a little more gray than I'd remembered, and yet it was long and still shiny. Her complexion glowed as if she was 7 years younger, not older. She looked happy, happier than I'd ever seen her in Colombia. Fresh tears welled up in my eyes. You got your nose done, I said.
Wow.
Yes, I did, she said proudly, a few years ago.
Seeing how much my mother had changed made me painfully aware of just how many years I'd locked her out, how much of our lives we'd missed, how weak I'd allowed our mother-daughter bond to become. She'd made this big decision to change her nose, and I had no part in it, nor any awareness of it. Her life had moved on without me. It hit me that we had no real relationship anymore, only the shadow of a former one. That realization made me feel so lonely. Not just on my behalf, but also on hers. Mommy reached up to hug me again and held me even more tightly than before.
It's okay, baby girl, she said. I'm here now.
From that first moment in the airport, it was clear to me that I wasn't there to reconnect with the mom who'd raised me. I was there to get acquainted with the person she'd grown into since. Nothing about her life in Madrid resembled the one she had in Colombia. For starters, she owned a car. One of those budget European models that looks like a toy. After we loaded my suitcase into the tiny trunk, I climbed into the front seat next to Mommy and went back to staring. Her side profile made her look even more different than she did face on.
Let's get out of here,
she said, revving up the engine, turning on the radio, and speeding from the lot. She seemed so independent, so in charge of herself, so spirited and sassy as she zipped through the streets. The last time I'd seen my mother drive, I was a kid. In Colombia, she'd gotten around by bike, so it was the weirdest thing all these years later to see my mother behind the wheel. She changed lanes with confidence, glancing back and forth between the road and me.
So how have you been, my love? She asked.
Good, I guess, I told her.
Should we stop by the grocery store and pick up something special for you to eat this evening? She asked.
I've already made your favorite, frijoles y arrocito.
That should be plenty, I said. Thanks. As my mom curved from one road to the next, I peered out to the city. The place reminded me a bit of New York. Cosmopolitan, sidewalks overflowing with people, little cafes with outdoor dining. The architecture, however, made it uniquely Madrid. Gothic churches and basilicas all over the place. Beautifully maintained plazas and squares. Mommy lived on the outskirts of the city, and about half an hour into our drive, and after we dropped off her friend for an appointment in the city,
we at last pulled into my mother's parking lot.
"Here we are,"
she said, yanking up the emergency brake. "It's not much, but it's home." Inside, the one bedroom was bare bones, a couch, a table with two chairs, and her queen bed and dresser in the bedroom. Yet by comparison to Mommy's previous homes in Colombia, it was quiet, and it was all hers. The walls were mostly bare, but she had a school photo of me at age 7 hanging at the center of one of them. I had this wide grin with 3 front teeth missing. I cringed when I noticed it. I no longer knew that little girl. Mommy still had to work long hours while I was in town, but we spent as much time together as we could. She took me to dinner one night, to a museum one day, and later in the trip, to a flamenco show. I spent a lot of the trip in awe that she had built a life for herself here. I think about it now, and that was probably because any recent memories I had of my mother were of her nervous, scared, and in hiding. There was no need to hide here, and no one was giving her any charity. A couple of years earlier, she'd gotten a job at a farm, taking care of animals. It didn't pay much, but it was far more than what she could earn in her country, and it was enough to cover her rent. It had also given her back this spirit of independence, this spark I was noticing in her. She wasn't just surviving in Madrid, she seemed to be thriving. At long last, she'd regained control of her life. How Mommy got her groove back. I liked it. I hadn't expected the trip to be a Hallmark reunion, but it was more difficult than I thought it would be. Just as my mother had changed, so had I. And that meant we clashed quite a bit. When you haven't seen someone in years, you have to literally relearn the person, figure out what makes him or her angry, scared, ticked off. And as we made those adjustments, silly tensions arose.
"Diane, your food is getting cold," Mommy would direct.
"Can you not tell me what to do?" I'd shoot back. "I'm not a kid anymore." Then as the days went on, she frequently wanted to reminisce about my childhood, about the old days.
"You remember how you used to play in the backyard with Dana and Gabriela when I was cooking?"
she asked. "Of course I do," I snapped. "But that was a long time ago, Mommy." In her mind's eye, those experiences were as vivid as if they'd happened the day before. And as I drifted further from her, she'd held those memories all the closer and more tightly. But for me, the recollections were like old, faded photos, ones I'd long since replaced with all the moments that came after. Mommy knew little of that life, and her mention of the previous one we'd share brought up so much anguish for me. Some of our moments together might have been tough, but many others were sweet. "My Muzi," I'd call my mother. She'd love that. During our time together, I'd make her laugh by taking on a Spanish accent and imitating the people around us. We took selfies all around the city. It was just me and Mama. I would make up little sketches on the street where I would pretend to be a Spanish reporter interviewing her about whatever monument or church we were in front of. Slowly, my memory of all the great times we'd shared began to come back. Even when I was little, my mother would indulge all my kooky shenanigans and let me play with her for hours. I remembered. "Mama, I loved you and you loved me. I was your little girl and you were my favorite." We filled our evenings with conversation, but seldom on any subject too painful for me to confront. She had figured out that I was not ready to discuss everything. It was still too raw for me. That changed 4 nights before the end of my trip. Over a bottle of Pinot Grigio, the two of us sat near each other on the couch. It was the first time I had ever shared a drink with my mother. Mommy, a little tipsy, started talking about the deportation.
"That whole time was so horrible for me," she said. "The prison was dirty. I couldn't communicate with your father. I couldn't eat or sleep."
As she spoke, my blood pressure rose. I sat up and cut her off.
"You know what, Mommy?"
I shouted.
"I don't want to hear another thing about how hard things were for you."
Mommy, caught off guard by my anger, stood.
"What are you talking about, Diane?"
You don't even know how hard things were for me, I shouted. It's always about you, isn't it? You, you, you. Tears came pouring out. You abandoned me, I howled, standing to point my forefinger right in her face. The words, once I'd never uttered aloud, came from some unknown place inside me, with a fire and fury that surprised me. You destroyed our family, I screamed. I hate you! Mommy widened her eyes, and then all at once, she too began to cry. She tried to pull me in her arms, and I resisted. But I was weeping so hard I couldn't keep my body stiff. I finally gave in to her pull and buried my face in her bosom. Diane, I never wanted to leave you, Mommy wailed. I did everything I could to stay with you. Everything! I never meant to hurt you. Mommy embraced me for the longest time, rubbing my back and swaying me from side to side as if I was again her baby. I'm so sorry, she whispered. Please forgive me. I'd spent nearly a decade making my mother wrong. I blamed her for deserting me, for taking the kinds of chances that put her at greater risk for deportation, for vanishing from my life at that very moment when I most craved her love, her care, her attention. And on that afternoon when I'd watched her wave goodbye through the back bars of a paddy wagon, I'd made a choice. One I wasn't conscious of. In the quietness of my heart, I decided that no apology Mommy could later offer would be sufficient. No explanation would be enough for me to let go of the deep bitterness toward her that I carried in my belly. I'd built a barrier from that rage, a partition so thick and so high that no one could peer around it. My mother might have left that detention center in 2001, but for years after, I held her a prisoner, the person most responsible for my heartache. I'd rendered her unforgivable, and in doing so, I'd also locked away myself, a part of my soul, and any hope that she and I would ever live at peace. That night, in the dim light of my mother's living room, I made a choice to free us both. On my last day in Madrid, Mommy drove me with her to the farm. When she turned on the radio, a familiar ballad by Cristian Castro, called Por Amarte Así, came on. And after we sang it together for a half minute, I stopped. What's the matter? Mommy asked me. Nothing, I said. What is it? She pressed. This song takes me back, I told her. Before she was deported for the last time, Mommy would often spruce up my bedroom just to make things nice for me. I'd come home from school and find yummy burning candles flickering, and sometimes she'd even have a little present waiting. One afternoon I spotted Castro's CD, Mi Vida Sin Tu Amor, propped up on my pillow. I fell in love with that album and listened to it so often that I almost broke it. Until we heard Castro's song on the radio, I'd nearly forgotten Mommy's gift all those years earlier. I'd carefully buried away the memory along with countless others. I've missed you so much, Mommy, I told her. I've missed you too, darling, she said. I cried the whole flight home. The sweet old woman seated next to me kept handing me tissues. It's okay, dear, she repeated. Everything will be fine. These weren't tears of sadness. They were tears of release, of freedom, of healing, of recognition. My mother had been dealt a whole hand of wild cards in life. She'd played them as well as she could, and in doing so, she'd managed something far braver than I ever might have attempted at her age. I had not yet learned to fully accept my reality, as she had been forced to. Even still, my mother has never been a bitter person. I'm amazed at her great spirit and her ability to soldier on in any challenge life presents her with. With a heart still burdened from a level of loss and grief I'd wish upon no one, Mommy mustered the courage, with Eric on her hip, to set out for a foreign land, a nation where she didn't speak the language, a country that provided a haven from the poverty and violence and despair she was desperate to flee. Along the way, she fell down, got up, and then toppled to her knees again. But in the end, she always got up. She crawled back to her feet, She stood. She deserved not my contempt, but my deepest admiration.
It was time for me to get a new manager. My breakthrough with Mommy had freed up this huge space inside me, and with my spirit so much lighter, I was eager to move ahead with my work. Susan Batson Studios hosted showcases, and there managers and agents could show up and evaluate our work. As soon as I returned from Madrid, I signed myself up for one and began searching for a monologue to present. I settled on one about a girl who had a troubled childhood, married young, and later became a meth addict. When I read the piece for Susan, yes, the real Susan Batson, she told me,
"This is a nice choice for you. It has a lot of dimension to it."
She gave me a couple of pointers, and later that week, I gave a powerful enough performance, if I do say so myself. Josh Taylor, an agent from Vam Nation Entertainment, was there that day. "That was amazing," Josh said to me afterward. "Can we talk?" "Sure," I said, blushing, as he handed me his card. A week later, I was in his office discussing the possibility of him representing me. I showed up wearing a crop top, ripped stockings, and platform boots. I looked like a homeless person, but thankfully, Josh didn't seem to notice. "I think you're very talented," he told me. "I think I can find you work." Frankly, I didn't know if he was boosting my ego or being serious, but either way, the encouragement felt good after months of being told I wasn't pretty enough, talented enough, experienced. So within days of our meeting, I started working with him. At his word, Josh began sending me out on auditions immediately. And in between auditions, he'd often check up on me. "How you holding up?" he'd call and ask. Many weeks, there'd be no auditions. The thing is, when casting directors don't know your work, they rarely want to even see you. And no matter how much your manager tells them, "She's fantastic," they roll their eyes and keep it moving. So during my downtime, I also kept tracking down my own opportunities on websites like Backstage and, of course, on CC, Creeper Craigslist. When none of those roles worked out, I began wondering if I should change my direction. "Maybe I should go back to school for theater," I thought. "Maybe I need some serious training." In the meantime, I auditioned myself silly. You name it, I tried out for it, from series like Glee to procedural dramas such as Law and Order. I'd go into these auditions, wait by the phone for days, and hear nothing. And later discover I'd been up against a real celeb. I once got beat out for a part by none other than Nina Dobrev from The Vampire Diaries. Excuse me, but how did it make any sense that I was even up for that role? No clue. Casting will assure you that they want a fresh face, only for you to later see that the name got it instead. So I'd go into these auditions thinking, whatever. I'm sure I have no shot. And in a way, that eased the pressure. In retrospect, I now realize this whole process was part of what it means to become an actor. You've got to put the time in. You've got to get out there and show casting directors who you are, and even if they don't hire you initially, they might circle back and ask to see you down the line. I know that now. You couldn't have convinced me of that then. I was cast in an episode of Are We There Yet?, the TV series based on the 2005 movie created by Ice Cube. That was over-the-moon exciting. I then got a central role in the indie film called Emoticon. The movie wasn't huge, but they paid me around $100 a day to film. That's real money. Plus, I got to travel to Mexico for some of the shooting. I also did a small part in the movie called My Man is a Loser with John Stamos. So a little at a time, I was building up my SAG credits and making a small name for myself. At least I was working and putting in the hours. It's only a matter of time before people are really going to get on the Diane Guerrero wagon, Josh always told me. Just hang in there. Bigger opportunities will come along. You have to build toward that. 1 week after I'd been turned down by a fresh slew of casting directors, Josh sent me a text. "There's this part I want you to try out for," he wrote. "It's a prison series, so don't wear any makeup for the audition and have your hair messy. Keep it as real and natural as possible." He mentioned that it was an internet thing. And since my big dream was to be on TV and in the movies, I wasn't exactly impressed. But who had the time or money to be picky? Ha! Not me. Remember, I wasn't above CC, Creeper Craigslist. Josh emailed me the site that evening so I could begin work on it. The character was a girl named Maritza, a spunky, tough ghetto girl whose bad choices have landed her behind bars. In the scene, Maritza is running for prison government and gets into a scuffle with her best friend Flaca. At the end of it, she pops off with a smart-ass couple of lines. Vote for Maritza if you want more pizza. Vote for Flaca, she's full of caca. How silly, I thought. It's a web series? Do people watch those? The day of the audition, I called my papi with the secret intention of getting a pep talk. I'm getting really discouraged by everything, I told him. It's so hard to keep going on all of these auditions. You can't give up so easily, Chivola, he told me. You're doing your best, right? And that's all you can do. Something's going to work out, trust me. Later that morning at 10, I showed up precisely as Josh had instructed, bare-faced and wearing sweats, a t-shirt and my combat boots. The look wasn't difficult to pull off, given I was more down in the dumps than I'd been in weeks. I'd gone through the motions of memorizing my part the night before, but I didn't truly want to be there. I kept thinking, I'll never get cast in anything, not even a web series. I delivered my lines for the casting director, Miss Jennifer Houston. And unlike so many others, she was approachable and happy. She put me at ease. That was good, she told me, but I want you to do it again for me, and this time I want you to make the character a lot tougher and with a lot more attitude. Let's get it on camera one more time. Oh, good. She's giving me another chance. She must think I'm decent if she wants me to do this over, I thought. Let me try and get into this. I stood up straight, focused myself, and launched into my first line. That's when something unexpected happened. The moment I began reading, I was transported. Back to Boston. Back to my early middle school years. Back to all those times when the girls in my hood got in my face and talked trash about me, accent white. My childhood was filled with dozens of Maritzas. And if I hadn't chosen a different path, I'd now be one of them. In those 3 minutes in front of the casting crew, I brought all those experiences to my character. Then at the end of the piece, just to add some drama, I got close to the camera and yelled out an ad-lib. Yo, fucking hit me! The team looked stunned. Sweetly, Jen said, great, that was it. Thanks for coming in, Diane. I left feeling so lifted, like I had lived a little bit of truth in that moment. Day one went by. No callback. 2 days turned into a week, which turned into three. Still nothing. Forget it, I told Josh. I'm sure they've gotten J-Lo to take the part by now, I joked. One day, about a month after the audition, my father rang to check on me. I had just gotten into bed to sulk. So how'd that audition go, he asked. I think I did okay, I told him, but I haven't heard anything, so you never know. I don't even care anymore. Well, did you give it your all, he asked. I gave it my all and then some, I told him. Then you've already won, he said. No, papi, I thought. I haven't won if I don't actually get the part. I didn't say that to my father, of course. I just thanked him, hung up, and scooted down under my comforter. You don't sell your old shoes to a random dude because you want a metaphorical victory. You don't move your entire life to New York City so you can earn the great effort trophy. You don't tuck a blue journal of dreams beneath your pillow at age 12 because you want to end up in second place as the also-ran. You take big risks so you can score big victories. You step out because, damn it, you want to be chosen. You want something to show for your effort. You want to be the girl who got the part. Almost as much as I wanted life itself, that is what I wished for. Chapter 16. Orange. One press account said I was an overnight success. I thought that was the longest night I've ever spent. Sandra Cisneros, novelist. It's not every day a girl gets to wear a red beak. At a makeup school in downtown Manhattan, I was having my first one ever attached, courtesy of my friend Court. I met this beautiful creature at the emoticon shoot a year before. She was the makeup artist on set, and I was immediately taken by her kind spirit and genuine personality. So anyway, Court was taking classes at Makeup Forever Academy. And for her final class project, she needed a model she could temporarily turn into a phoenix using prosthetics and cosmetics. Enter me, the near-starving artist desperate for rent money. Makeup Forever can pay you $150 for your time, Court told me. Boom, sold. The prosthetic was huge and clunky. Court was doing her best to fit the latex prosthetic over my nose with spirit gum, a glue that can be used on skin.
Can you hold still so I can get this on here right? She said.
I could hardly speak, or for that matter, breathe, because the nose piece covered so much of my face. I managed to get out. This is going to be fly, she said, so to speak. Just as she was gluing down the edges, my cell rang. Trying to keep my face as steady as possible for Court, I pulled the phone from my pocket and answered it.
Hello? I managed to mutter.
I sounded muffled, like I had just stuffed a ball of cotton candy in my mouth.
Hey, Diane! This is Josh,
I heard, and for whatever reason, he sounded out of breath.
What's up?
I asked. I have some news for you, he said. Do you remember your audition for a show called Orange is the New Black? I froze.
Orange who?
I said. Court, who was throwing me the stink eye, motioned for me to get off the phone. Josh laughed.
You know, he told me, it's the internet prison show you went out for. And you got it! You landed a recurring role for the character Maritza Ramos.
I dropped the phone. Oh my God! I yelled, jumping up and down. The beak's right edge slid off and dangled over my mouth. A couple of other makeup artists and models stared over at me like I was possessed. Court looked at me and smiled like a proud mama.
I got the part, I shrieked. I got the part.
I picked up the cell phone and pressed it to my ear again. Josh, are you still there? I asked.
Yep,
I'm here, he said, chuckling.
Are you kidding me? I asked.
I'm not kidding at all, he told me. In fact, they want you to start filming in about 4 weeks. My head spun.
So, like, how many episodes would I get? I asked excitedly.
We don't know that yet, he told me. Could be 2, could be 5, could be 8, but you're in! After a scream fest with Court, I stuck around long enough for her to reattach my beak. Roll or no roll, I needed that $150 by week's end. But once I left the school, I cannot even tell you how I even got home because the whole way there, I was in the zombie zone. Is this actually happening? I kept thinking. Am I going to be on a show for longer than 5 seconds?
The last time I'd been so worked up was over that Kmart commercial.
That was nothing compared to the thrill and shock of this.
Me? For real?
Some actors go years without ever landing a recurring role. I mean, look, they weren't committing to me the way they would a series regular, but I didn't care. In my eyes, we had a little time to date and get to know each other before they fell in love with me. By the next morning, my euphoria had turned into trepidation. What had I gotten myself into? Who was in this? What was this whole web series thing about anyway? The crazy thing is, I'd done zero research in preparation for the audition. That's how I am. I like to just show up and roll with things. Sometimes that strategy works for me because I'm open to whatever unfolds, and other times that has bitten me in the ass. Josh had mentioned something about Netflix, but at the time, that didn't mean what it does now. I thought of Netflix as a place to order movies, and although some folks were turning to web content as their main source of entertainment, that wasn't yet widely known. And then, when I heard web series, I figured it could involve anything from a few friends making a movie in a backyard to a smallish production. That's basically why I dismissed it, until I didn't get a callback, at which point it felt like the biggest letdown of my acting career. Over the next couple days, I went through the same stages that a lot of us actors go through. First, there's a zombie stage. Then, there's a super excited stage. Then, there's a scared as hell, what if I can't deliver stage? Followed by the super diva, excuse me, do you know who I am? Gods, take him away! Stage. In short, I was a mess. But at least, I was a mess with a job. Josh gave me the scoop on the series. It had been created by Jenji Cohen, the badass writer who created Weeds on Showtime. The show, which is based on Piper Kerman's best-selling memoir by the same name, is set at a fictional minimum security women's penitentiary in Litchfield, an actual town in upstate New York, although the real-life town has no prison. The show revolves around the main character, Piper Chapman, an upper-middle-class New Yorker whose past comes back to haunt her and lands her at Litchfield alongside an, colorful crew of other inmates. Some of the scenes will be filmed upstate, in an abandoned children's mental ward, Josh told me. Most others, including episode 2, which would be my first appearance, would be shot in the city. I still had no idea who any of the other castmates would be. But this was starting to sound like the big time. This was a series with a full budget and its very own set. 1 month and many sleepless nights later, I turned up at the iconic Kaufman Astoria Studios in Queens at 9 a.m. sharp. The building itself is enormous. As I roamed around looking for the orange set, I passed through a long hallway filled with signed photos from some of the greats who'd worked there. Frank Sinatra, George Burns, Lena Horne, Paul Robeson. Productions such as Goodfellas and Hair had been filmed in the studio. In one corner of the building, I noticed the set of Sesame Street, complete with Oscar the Grouch's trash can and the big Sesame Street sign.
So cool.
Just across from it was the set of Nurse Jackie. I finally spotted the double doors marked orange. Pure insanity. That's what I found inside. In this huge waiting area, throngs of actors, producers, and background artists milled around. I signed in with the AD. And then I stood there and drooled like a dumbfounded schoolgirl. Real actors, those with films and TV shows I recognized and admired, were all over the place. Jason Biggs, American Pie, Natasha Lyonne, Slums of Beverly Hills, Laura Prepon, That 70s Show, Taryn Manning, Crossroads. I was like, what is this thing? These were actors, and I was about to work on the same show with them. Eek! Good thing I didn't know in advance who'd been hired. If I had, I may have not shown up. That's how much of a nervous wreck I instantly became. On the set, women, all shapes, sizes, and colors were all over the place. Some of the bigger stars were chatting with each other and hanging out with the producers, but most of the rest of us, the extras and newbies, were standing around like geeks, checking each other out. I'm sure I wasn't the only one thinking, how will I ever measure up in this crowd? No one said much to me, nor did I speak. Whenever I'm in a new situation, I get shy, especially when the stakes are high, and especially when almost everyone in the room has been in some of my favorite TV shows and movies. After a few minutes of gawking, I found my way to a row of side chairs and took a seat. What's the protocol? And should I be mingling? From the looks of it, a few of the seasoned actors had already formed cliques, probably when they shot the pilot months before. This must be how it goes in showbiz, I thought. I had no idea what to say or do, which is why I'll always be grateful to the actor who broke the ice. My name is Uzo, said this vibrant black woman with kind eyes. She had such a commanding presence, so regal. She smiled and extended her hand, which I shook. What's your name? She asked. I'm Diane, I said, fidgeting in the chair. Diane Guerrero. She sat in the seat across from me. Where are you from, Diane? She asked. Boston, originally, I told her. Her face lit up. Really? She said. I'm from there, too. I liked Uzo Aduba from that first conversation. She seemed so sure of herself, but also quite warm, which brought my blood pressure down to normal. We traded stories about Boston, and after I gave her the digestible version of my story, she told me a little about her family. Her parents had come to the United States from Nigeria. My mom is so amazing, she said. She's like my biggest fan. She's always like, Zozo, you can do it. You have to keep going. And here I am. On Orange, Uzo had been tapped to play Suzanne Warren, as in Crazy Eyes, as in the portrayal that would eventually earn her 2 Emmys and a SAG Award. What's your character? She asked me. Maritza Ramos, I told her.
Cool, she said.
And just then, the AD interrupted us to pull me aside. We're sending you to hair and makeup now, she told me. Just go back to the right and down the hall. I nodded, looked over my shoulder to smile at Uzo, and stepped off. My hair had never been longer, like down past the small of my back. The hairstylist brushed it silky and then pulled it to the side while the makeup artist started working her magic. Maritza and her Latina crew are supposed to have this ghetto glam look. Mission accomplished. By the time the team got done with me, I could have fit right in on the streets of East LA. Very chola-y. My liner was thick, dark brown lipstick, almost burgundy, was smeared all over my lips. Next stop, wardrobe. Costume handed me a fresh set of khaki-colored two-piece scrubs. Put these on, she told me. Can I tell you a secret? I love my outfit on orange more than any other costume I've ever had to wear. It's simple, it's comfortable, it's basic, and no worrying about how my boobs or butt will look in a tight dress. It's also almost exactly what everyone else is wearing, though we all have a different signature way of wearing the scrubs. We are stylish women, after all. The fact that we had to wear the same clothing made me feel like I was part of something, a community. From day one for me, it wasn't about coming in and trying to be the cute girl. I wanted to be a serious actor doing serious work, not the one only concerned about looks. When I emerged from the changing area, another AD met me. We're running behind today, she told me, but we'll come and get you when your scene comes up. I nodded. Make yourself comfortable, she told me. It could be a while. She dropped me off in another waiting area, one filled with a crop of actors I hadn't seen earlier. The other faces were new and fresh, just like mine. Danielle Brooks, Samira Wiley, Emma Miles. Those three were sitting in a circle across the room, cracking up and eating lunch together. And clearly already bonded. I saw an empty chair in a far corner and shuffled toward it. A few minutes later, Danielle got my attention. Hey, girl, she shouted across the room. What's your name? She wandered toward me. I'm Diane, I said shyly when she got close. So why are you sitting over there all quiet? She said with a grin. I don't know, I said. It's my first day. I don't even know if they're going to use me. Do you think they'll cut me? Do you usually have to sit around for a while? She laughed. Wait. Slow down, girl, she said. They'll get to you. Don't worry. Just chill. Come and hang with us until they do. I followed her back across the room, where she introduced me to the crew. Hey, guys, this is Diane, she announced. And she's nervous she's going to be cut. But she's not going anywhere. Can we please show her some love? The girls snickered and applauded. A couple of them gave me high fives. Maybe this isn't too bad. So, who are you playing? Emma asked me. I told her all about Maritza, but as I spoke, I couldn't help but notice her horrible teeth. Yellow, like they were rotting. Gross. I was like, damn, they're really using real people for this. Oh, I'm sorry, she cut in. I meant to tell you, these aren't my real teeth. I let out a chuckle, the kind that told her I'd indeed been judging her dental situation. I play a meth head on the show, she said. They just smear crap on my teeth. I'm usually much better looking than this. Hilarious. One by one, over the next 3 hours, the actors were called in to shoot their scenes. A couple went off at 2 p.m., someone else around 4, a few others at 6 and 9. By midnight, only 5 others and I were still in the room. Finally, at 2 a.m., my number came up. Come with me, said the AD. The others and I followed her to Video Village, the area on the set where all the directors and producers congregate. When I rounded the corner, several senior producers looked me up and down. And then they got into a little huddle and started whispering. Oh, Lord, I thought. They're definitely sending me home. After a minute, which felt more like 30, one of them came up to me. You look too pretty, she said. I raised my eyebrows. Huh? I said. You're too made up for this role, she explained. This isn't going to work. We need Maritza to be way less glamorous. We're sending you back to hair and makeup. Off I went, and I returned without lipstick. The producer seemed to approve of the new look and escorted me to the set. one of the most basic I've ever seen. A cafeteria, a rec room, a kitchen, a cafeteria, and a commissary. And a cell with bunks inside, which is where my first star turn took place. All the actors in my scene were already there, waiting for me to return from my cosmetic strip-down. Hardly before I could gather my thoughts, the director called out, "Action!" Long story short, I blew the first scene. In it, I get into this little dust-up with a couple of the Latina girls. Three of the actors in my scene, Elizabeth Rodriguez, Aleida, Dasha Polanco, Dayanara, and Selene Sleva, Gloria, had worked together in episode 1. They had a rhythm. I, however, had my tongue in my throat. I'd been given 3 lines to memorize, and I flubbed every single one. "Cut!" the director kept yelling. How embarrassing. We tried it again, and again, and again. I still don't know if the director called it a night because he was satisfied, or because at 3:15 a.m. he was too exhausted to continue. Then again, not everything is about you, Diane. Jeez. Given how awful that first scene went, I had to pry myself out of bed for the following day's filming. Each episode requires about 9 days of shooting. Not until day 3 did I turn the corner and really start to relax. That had a lot to do with meeting Jackie Cruz, who plays Flaca, Maritza's best friend. We instantly hit it off. She's so spunky, so fun, so approachable. "Hey, do you want to have lunch?" she asked me that first week. "Sure," I said. That was the beginning of not just a work camaraderie, but a real friendship. I'll tell you more about that in a sec. The cast was huge, and up to this point, I was meeting a new character every half hour. And as shy as I was, meeting Taylor Schilling, who plays Piper, was very cool. She seemed so dedicated. She was tall, with a big smile and an infectious laugh that reminded me of my college roomie, Adrian. She mentioned she was from Boston, and that filled me with pride. Hell yes. 3 girls from the Bean on a show together in New York. Eat that, whatever town or city hates on Boston. My sole focus is playing the hell out of Maritza. Who is she, really? I get asked by a lot of fans and interviewers. What's her story? Here's the thing. On a show like Orange, the characters unfold for us actors nearly as slowly as they do for our viewers. The writers only give us a script for the following episode, not the full season. So I'm still getting to know Maritza myself. And this is what I can tell you about her. She's a spitfire. She's got a silly side. She's always trying to make the most of her situation. And she's desperately seeking a family. Some security. Sound familiar? And while she's smart, I don't think she cares about trying too hard. She's a girl who's had to use whatever is available to her, like many others in her situation. I can think of a few girls like that. I think you'll find that Maritza is a lot more than she seems. In season 4, and hopefully beyond, you will see more of who Maritza is, as well as her baggage. I have fun all the time with the different possibilities for her life. In one scenario I've played with, Maritza comes from a wealthy white suburban family who adopted her at birth. She has grown up grappling with identity issues. When her mom shows up at Litchfield to see her, she's like, "Maritza, why are you talking like you're from the streets, dear? What would the gals in the country club say if they heard you speaking in that way after all we've done for you?" That storyline, among others, makes me laugh. We'll see how that jibes with what the writers create. The truth is that this show is so freaking good that there's no doubt that we'll continue to amaze and grab your attention with all the wonderful stories we bring to life. Real stories about real women. As Leah Delaria, a.k.a. Big Boo, would say, "Fuck yeah!" When I think about the show entering its 4th season, things seem so different than they were in the beginning. My worries have changed. My heart is in a different place. I cannot believe how much I've grown throughout this whole experience. I feel like I belong to a family, like I'm part of something bigger. Since the first season, we, as a show, have broken so many barriers and brought light to so many important issues in need of attention. How many shows can you say have done that? Not only have we changed the way people watch television, we've bred a whole crew of activists. How wonderful to be part of such social and political awareness. Dope. We are fighting for women's rights, LGBT rights, social equality, prison reform, and now I hope my brothers and sisters join me in the fight for immigration reform. Maritza's most memorable line so far is the one I auditioned with. And it's not just because I'm in the episode. Okay, yes, it's because I'm in it. Duh. That it became one of my favorites of the first season. In all seriousness, it was after that episode when I first began noticing that people were recognizing me. I started seeing internet memes of myself with "Vote for Maritza if you want more pizza" as the caption underneath. I swear, people still randomly come up to me on the streets and yell that line. It felt ridiculous when I said it. I even cringed when I watched it later. Which is why it's funny and ironic that it turned out to be one of Maritza's best moments. A lot of my scenes are with Jackie, who's about 80 inches taller than I am. Seriously, she stands 5 feet 9 to my 5 feet 2. The writers hadn't initially planned for our characters to be such close friends, but when they noticed how cool Jackie and I had become in real life, they went with that and altered our storylines. Or at least, this is the story Jackie and I have planned to tell our grandchildren. So, whether I'm fuzzy on the details of how our characters became so close is of no importance. In episode 6 of season 2, our on-camera connection suddenly got hotter. When I read that week's script, it involved a Valentine's party, some hooch, aka prison moonshine, and a smooch between two besties. It was wicked awkward. I immediately started hyperventilating when I realized Jackie and I would have to kiss. I'd never done a kissing scene, much less a girl-on-girl one. And since Jackie and I are such great buds off-camera, it made it all the weirder. For the entire week, I practiced my kissing technique in the mirror. I put my lips right up to the glass, closed my eyes, and then peeked to see how it appeared. In a word, disturbing. I looked cross-eyed with lips all poked out. I didn't even want to consider how it would look to other people. When you're kissing someone in real life, you don't pay attention how you look. You're not supposed to. You're in the moment. Your face gets ugly. You might even slobber. Jackie and I didn't talk to each other about any of this in advance. She probably felt just as strange about it as I did. So when we showed up on set that day, we were both nervous. "You ready for this?" she asked. "Ready as I'll ever be," I said, giggling. It's one thing to simply peck someone on the lips. It's an entirely different matter to perform a makeout session. In the case of the latter, you get self-conscious. People are watching you, repositioning you, and talking you through it. "Try to angle yourself to the left, Diane," the director instructed. By the end of it, I didn't care whether I was kissing my girlfriend or a hippopotamus. I just wanted the whole ordeal to be over with. And soon enough, it was. Flaca, and yes, it helped to keep reminding myself that it was Flaca kissing Maritza, not Jackie kissing Diane, leaned in and planted one on me. Things got heavy, and then we both stopped and went, "Nah." Afterward, over lunch, Jackie and I had a laugh about the whole thing and got right back into being what we are to this day, platonic pals. Although now and again she gets a little grabby and I have to splash cold water on her face to get her little paws off me. "You totally want me," she'll joke. "Oh my God, Jack, get over yourself. I do not," I'll tell her. "Then why are you blushing?" "Ugh, because you're making me blush." We crack up at the fact that I'm so uncomfortable with people touching me and giving me long hugs. Leave it to your friends to point out your weird hang-ups and quirks. "You're not touchy-feely, are you?" she'll tease. "What, me?" Right then, a slew of moments when I've gotten stiff in various social encounters will flash through my head. I'll be your rock and a shoulder to cry on, but don't get too close to my body or I'll turn stiff as a board. Unless I'm drunk or actively trying to seduce you. Yep, very primal over here. I'm still working on that. My mom says it's because I have trust issues, because of my trauma as a kid, blah, blah, blah. Even if we weren't on a hit show together, I'd hang with Jackie. I can be my goofy self around her. No judgments. In fact, she's just as silly. We do a lot of stuff together offset. We've gone to the ballet, we try out different restaurants, and above all else, we're black belt shoppers. After a day of filming, for instance, we always hit up the stores in Soho. From there, we might go get our nails done, but not without a few hundred selfies, courtesy of selfie queen Cruz. I protest, but I have to say that without her, I probably wouldn't have any accounts of my outings. With so much estrogen on the set of Orange, some might think there'd be constant bickering. In fact, it's empowering and full of free expression. An environment mostly run by women for women. This is one reason I appreciate Jenji Cohen and the Orange producers so much. Not only has Jenji changed my life, she has inspired me through her leadership. Working on a production like this one has taught me that there's no limit to what I can do. I can be strong and be a woman at the same time. I know that this sounds dated and that the women's liberation movement already happened, but we still deal with societal pressures that tell us we're not as strong or competent as men. Jenji is a constant reminder that that's not the case. She is a fighter for women and has chosen Piper Kerman's story along with the story of millions of women in the prison system to show how powerful we really are. She's shining a light on the injustices that we face. We need more women like you, Jenji, and I hope to be one of them, someone who's contributing for a better and more just world in which women are equal to men. I'd say the ladies on the cast of Orange are some of the best I've ever met in my life. It's not uncommon to walk by a dressing room and hear laughter or singing or even crying. We're real people and we bring our true selves with us onto the set. We're there for each other and not just the cast, but the whole doggone crew. I've never seen a better run production. We're hardworking and happy. I feel respected and valued. Being there reminds me of my time at Boston Arts Academy. There's no filter on what you can say, and I know that my feelings are safe there. Even with all the love and the warmth on the show, there have still been some tough days for me. For one thing, no one in the cast, including Jackie, knew what had happened in my family. I kept that to myself because I was ashamed of it, and because I didn't want to think about it or discuss it. But how can you refuse to acknowledge something when your whole environment is one big screaming reminder? With just about every script in almost every corner of the set, I was faced with the truth. This was my parents' life. My mother had sat in handcuffs. My father had once worn an orange jumpsuit, just like the dozens that sat folded in our wardrobe department. For the other actors and me on our show, this was all a fantasy, the recreation of a world we knew little about. For Mommy and Papi, it could not have been more real or painful. I tried to use the experience to access my raw feelings and channel them into my portrayal, the way I'd been taught to do at Susan Batson. Some days, I worked beautifully. Other days, I'd end up upset or numb. I've had so many scenes in which Flaca and I are doing the dirty work, like cleaning the kitchen or mopping the floors, which is when I think about my parents the most. Long before they ended up in prison, they'd spent years handling the nastiest jobs, the ones often avoided by others. Manual labor, low pay, little respect. They must have felt so trapped. It must have been so hard for them to maintain their dignity when others looked down on them or worse, didn't see them at all. As we wrapped up shooting season one, the show's material suddenly hit even a little closer to home. My brother called me with some news about his daughter, my niece Erica. The two of us had long since fallen out of touch, and I've always deeply regretted that. So when Eric told me that she'd gotten caught up with the wrong crowd in high school and had ended up in jail, it broke my heart. A few years earlier, Gloria had apparently realized Erica was headed toward trouble, and she'd done all she could to steer her back on track. But with my brother away in Colombia and with the struggles that go along with raising a child on one income in a tough neighborhood, Gloria's efforts weren't enough to save her beloved daughter from a difficult situation. I experienced many emotions when I heard about Erica. Guilt that I hadn't somehow managed to stay connected with her. Anger that she'd been forced to grow up without the nurturing presence of my parents and the guidance of her father. And sadness that she'd stumbled into a hole she couldn't pull herself out of. Here I was, experiencing the happiest moment in my career, portraying a woman's life in a fictitious penitentiary, and my only niece, my own flesh and blood, was living through her lowest point while in an actual prison. That, along with all my parents had survived, made my work on Orange bittersweet. Life can indeed imitate art, and at times, it does so agonizingly well. During my second season of filming for Orange, I got a call from Josh. "There's another show we want you to go in for," he told me. I went into